You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Episode number 61, Practical Steps to Apply the Composite S-Demand Strategy, an interview with Michael O'Kelly. Welcome to The Effective Statistician with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, the weekly podcast for statisticians in the health sector who want to reach their potential to serve patients without becoming overwhelmed at work. So, we have a really, really nice newsletter. Just get on The Effective Statistician and register there. And please also add Alexander at TheEffectiveStatistician.com to your contacts to make sure it doesn't end in your spam folder. We have an upcoming webinar, May 29th at 4 p.m. Central European Time, which is 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll talk about mastering the art and the science of influential communication for statisticians. In this webinar, where you can find more information actually on TheEffectiveStatistician.com/webinar, you'll learn about challenges when communicating, keys to be more influential, how you can work with challenging audiences, why a strong start is really important, and three simple things you can do now to improve your communication. So register for this webinar end of May at May 29th. Don't miss this opportunity, become more effective at work and reduce your frustrations about not being heard or understood. In today's episode, we talk about the composite treatment strategy to address intercurrent events. And first we'll dive into a new term, non-ascertainable outcomes, and why we should use this term more often. We'll also talk about how we can combine or construct composite endpoints, and in depth how we can analyze these endpoints in the best way, and what are the differences in interpretation of these different approaches. As usual, this podcast is created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the special interest groups, the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. We have a reduced rates at only £20 for non-high income countries, and still it's only a very reasonable £95 for high income countries. Just visit the PSI website, psiweb.org, to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. And today I have a guest here, Michael O'Kelly. Hi, Michael, how are you doing?
Good, thank you, Alexander. And yourself?
Very good. Nice to having you here. Today we are talking about a very hot topic, a pretty hot topic for a couple of years now in the biostatistics community. And we are talking again about estimates. So there's a couple of different estimate sessions or episodes on this podcast already. So you can scroll back and look into a couple of these. And today we are talking about a specific strategy in the estimate space. And it's also something that Michael will present about in the upcoming PSI conference. So if you haven't registered for this conference yet, I would strongly encourage you to do it. It will be an awesome conference in London early June. Okay, now let's dive into the topic. But before we do that, Michael, maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit and what got you into these interesting topic of estimates?
Sure, Alexander. I'm originally a graduate in languages, with ancient Greek being my favorite. And it was only after about a dozen years that I realized how interesting stats were. So got a PhD from my local university, University College Dublin, in statistics, and I've been 27 years in Quintiles, now IQVIA, as a statistician. And for the last 10 of those, I think, myself and what I call my research pal, Bodana Ratic, who works in Montreal, have been working together on looking at useful methods for missing data, and a term which is now completely unfashionable. So we now have to say looking at methods to implement interesting estimands. I actually wasn't sure I was too interested in the topic at first, until I realized the fabulous opportunities there are for statistical modeling when looking at and handling and trying to deal with the imperfections of the data that we get in our clinical trials. And it's as I've studied it more and more, worked with others about it, it's become more and more interesting and satisfying as an area for research.
Yeah, I also think it's a really, really interesting area. And, you know, formally we have always kind of looked into imperfect data in the area of observational research. And now we are learning that we are, you know, applying a couple of these approaches that we have used in observational research for a long time, that we can also apply these approaches in clinical trials to overcome these specific problems there, and we get a better understanding of the estimates. And that also kind of then back translates into what we can actually do with observational data as well, and understand really what we have been doing there for quite some time in terms of having different estimates, just not really realizing it. So it's a really, really interesting topic where different research areas are kind of inspiring each other. And that's what I find really, really motivating to work on it. So in terms of missing data and estimates, there's an interesting term that we first want to talk about, and that is called non-ascertainable outcomes. Can you give a little bit of a background of what that is and maybe give some examples?
Sure. Non-ascertainable outcomes, it's something that people are using more frequently. And you could say that it's just a fancy term for missing data. But as I mentioned earlier, people are finding more and more that the term missing data just isn't satisfactory. It's almost conveys an attitude towards the data that we can't use or don't have, that, oh, well, that's the state of affairs. We just have to kind of compensate for it. So it's not just a scientific description, I think people are feeling. It's like it conveys an attitude towards the data that we're trying to use. And so people, one step towards a move away from missing data was this, the growth in the belief of the importance of being precise about what we want to estimate, the estimand, that is. And so people began to realize that there might be data that you even have, but which you can't use. So that's not exactly missing data. You can see how inadequate the term missing becomes then, mm-hmm. if you start becoming sophisticated about what you want and kind of scientific about what you want to estimate. So, for instance, one obvious and kind of clear-cut example of non-ascertainable data or non-ascertainable outcome could be, say, if you're trying to measure quality of life in an indication which is quite serious and where a significant proportion of the patients you're studying are expected to die. There, you simply mm-hmm. couldn't ascertain quality of life. At least that's the common position after death, although I believe that some measures of quality of life actually do assign a score of zero to the state of being dead. But that few, I think, find that satisfactory as a kind of a solution there. So, but that's kind of like a simpler case.
So, yeah, I really like the outcome the outcome word in non-asset inevitable outcomes as well, because it makes clear that we are speaking about outcomes and not kind of other data that could be missing, like baseline data or things like that. Missing data is a pretty broad term, and there's also lots of research going on in terms of missing covariates and what kind of impact that could have on all kind of different things, especially in the epidemiology area. So I think it's not only about the missing, it's also about the outcome word that is
right. But the example I quoted there was a relatively simple one, where you wouldn't necessarily have to drag in the estimand word. Sorry, my computer just went blank. I have to type in my password. Right. There are more kind of sophisticated examples of non-ascertainable data, which I think are helpful will be helpful in our discussion today. An example might be what's non-ascertainable, the definition of what's non-ascertainable gets bound up with what you want to estimate or the estimand. Supposing you wish to estimate efficacy omitting the effect of rescue medication, which is common enough because or a common enough need, because for many purposes the effects of rescue medication are simply a nuisance. The outcomes measured after rescue medication is taken are irrelevant to the estimand, and so the outcome you want at a particular time point post rescue is non-ascertainable. Can you see that?
But it's
if you use the old-fashioned term missing, you've created missing data because of what you want to estimate. That's one perverse way of looking at it. And I mean, a more common example might be that you want to look at efficacy on treatment. Then any outcomes post-treatment, if someone stops treatment early, for those periods post-treatment, you have non-ascertainable outcomes either for purposes of your estimand. So you can see how this term missing just becomes far too bland and broad for the new way of thinking, which realizes that the data we want to use in estimating something is bound up with what we want to estimate.
Yeah, and I think it's very important to have good wording for what we describe to avoid confusion and to be clear about things. So I really like this term, not ascertainable. Also, I need to say it's much more difficult to say for a non-native speaker than missing.
Estimand is bad enough.
Okay.
As you probably know, the suffix there originated in Latin grammar, where the addition of the A-N-D at the end of a verb conveyed the idea of what should be done with that verb. So very obscure origin, to my mind, of a term which should be relatively simple, what we want to estimate. Sorry.
Yep. It's really nice to have someone with that kind of ancient Greek language background to actually explain it.
It comes in ever so useful, I assure you.
Okay, so in terms of the different strategies or the different estimates, today we want to talk not across all the different strategies, but we want to talk just about the composite strategy. And in your presentation at the PSI conference, you'll actually also talk about principled stratum strategy, which is another very fascinating topic. But as we want to kind of restrict the length of the podcast episode here, we'll focus just on the composite one. I'm pretty sure we'll have opportunity to speak about the other very interesting area in the
future. Yeah, as we in our discussion prior to this podcast, you remember I was enthusing about the idea of principal stratum. To me, it's a great deal more attractive as a way of attacking this problem than the old composite. But composite is probably at the moment certainly much more widely used, and so I'm glad to be going through this today.
Okay, so how could you actually come up with a composite endpoint to solve this problem of having non-ascertainable outcomes? Could you give a couple of examples?
Right. That's the first teenager invasion here. Just wait for my daughter to leave. Okay. Door shut. Right. A good example, I think, is the one we started out with, where you have your objective is to make some assessment of quality of life in an indication where a significant proportion of the people in a study are expected to die. Now, that significant proportion need not be that enormously high, but something like even 5 to 10% of people expected not to survive to the end of the study is enough to be an important factor to take into account when assessing, say, quality of life. But the consensus seems to be that there is no really ultimately satisfactory way of assessing quality of life when there's a significant proportion of deaths in your study. But what you can do is make attempts to do so. And one of them there's all the attempts we're going to cover here today involve including the event that is intruding, including that event in your assessment of the item of main interest. So in the case of quality of life measure, which is in effect censored by death, the composite approach attempts to take or to include death in the assessment of quality of life. So because death is a blunt yes or no kind of a thing, and you want to join it with a quality of life score, which could be quite a granular and almost certainly pseudo-continuous measure, you can see that it's unavoidable that there will be some loss of granularity when you try to include the intrusive event in the endpoint, making it a composite endpoint. So you can have the blunting of the precision or granularity could be as bad as reducing your quality of life simply to a success failure type of endpoint, and that's probably the kind of composite approach that people are most familiar with. There.
So just dichotomizing it, yeah. and saying everybody that is dead is a failure, and everybody that is still alive and has good quality of life is a success, so to say.
Yes. So, and every quality of life.
The beauty of that is it's very easy and it's very simple to interpret.
Exactly. And for many measures of quality of life, there will be some clinically accepted change that is regarded as, say, deterioration, that varies from indication to indication and score to score. But yes, so that you can have deterioration, which includes death. That's the bluntest, probably. But you can get, as it were, a bit more granularity than that in your composite endpoint. In the case of our example of death, for instance, one could include the date of death in the measure. So you begin, you could go as fine in your granularity as, say, ranking in some way the quality of life score, with death being a worse rank than the worst from the observed scores, and with the death itself ranked by time of death, with the earliest death being the worst. So you gain a little bit of sensitivity there, but you can see also that you're beginning to lose in interpretability.
So you could have something like great quality of life, moderate quality of life, low quality of life, deaths, early deaths, very early deaths, or something like that as a kind of ranking. Yeah,
you could. The convention is to simply rank in the ordinary sense of the word by ranking within visit, so that the person with the best quality of life gets ranked number one, and say, depending on the range of the score, supposing the worst ranked person across all treatment groups for visit is ranked at 120. The latest death would be rank 121, and so on down to the earliest death. So pure and simple. But yes, indeed, and maybe we'll come to that in more detail. An approach which one of which we'll be describing at the session would be to break up the score of interest into categories that make some kind of clinical sense, say maybe improved, steady, deteriorated, and died, with obviously those being in order of desirability, as it were. And you can immediately see that you can apply all kinds of methods appropriate to ordinal data to that kind of composite outcome.
So things like proportional odds models, or ranking based approaches like Wilcoxon-Whitney test, or these kinds of things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And maybe we can go into those in a minute, but I should maybe just mention another possible composite approach, which is much talked about, although its difficulties in interpretation are such as that many people are put off it, and that's the trimmed mean approach, where you could pre-specify some kind of proportion of your enrolled patients, which is likely to be greater than the proportion expected to die in our example, and only allow yourself to to estimate the mean outcome based on that the ranked subjects above that proportion. So say supposing at the most 10% of your subjects were expected not to live to the end of the study, you could say pre-plan to look at the top 85% in both treatment mm-hmm. groups. So that's another rather ingenious way of taking into account or making the event part of the definition of your endpoint. That's been advocated or described with enthusiasm by Tom Permuth and others from FDA, and that's kind of brought it to people's attention a bit.
So basically you would look into not all patients, but by definition you would exclude, let's say, the worst 10 or 15%, and you would say, okay, we are only interested in, you know, the best 80, 85, 90% of the patients. And by that, you know, then we have no non-ascertainable outcomes or only ascertainable outcomes, and that way we are fine.
Yeah, a lot of people, including myself, would probably quarrel with the last sentence that we are fine. First of all, of course, it depends on how you define those the people you're going to leave out. In the papers that have been written on this particular method, it would be not just non-ascertainable outcomes in terms of death that we've been talking about, but maybe all missing data would be counted as of the by implication a lower rank. But there's a number of issues with this method. One is, of course, that it just leaves out patients for whom we may have partial data, which is always repugnant to a statistician, I think. It's not an insuperable difficulty, but it is a problem or an issue with it. The other is the interpretation of it, because you have to say that the estimate of treatment effect is the estimate in the best X percent of patients. So that is, if I were a patient with the indication, it's hard for me to know, well, do the findings of this clinical trial apply to me at all? Am I one of the best 85% or whatever? And nobody really knows. So there are problems of interpretation with it as well. Interestingly, shall I just go? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But however, as a patient, you know, kind of, you will have, by definition, 85% probability to fall into that if you don't know anything else, you know. So you basically can, you know, roll the dice and say, okay, if I'm in that part, then at least I know exactly what to expect. If I'm in the other part, I get, so to say, some other things. And where I think it would also kind of make it a little bit more complex, if you do that kind of across different endpoints, would you then kind of have it, you know, a different proportion for different endpoints, or, you know, would the population be stable? So would you, you know, just make this kind of 85% cut for based on your primary endpoint and then keep it for all the other secondary and safety endpoints as well? Or, you know, how would you deal with kind of this question?
All I can say is, good question. I should have maybe given a bit more detail about how the proportion is selected. In many accounts of this trimmed mean approach, people would say, well, wait and see what proportion do die and find out which is the treatment group with the highest proportion and then cut off both treatment groups at that highest proportion. But there's an element of being data driven there that I figured made that a less attractive, so I didn't mention it, but that is another possibility. And I mention it now because it's implicit in what you're saying, that if you happen to have, say, if one outcome has a lot of missing data and another outcome has very little missing data, if you went for the data-driven approach, you'd have a different population for each of your different trimmed means for the two outcomes, right? And of course, if we're just dealing with death, that's a fixed proportion which you would presumably be able to apply. You base your proportion on that and have a fixed proportion. And of course, you could go for, say, the upper 40% and be pretty sure of catching all outcomes, primary, secondary, and exploratory, or whatever. There's an element of arbitrariness that certainly makes me uneasy. However, I can see it's less of an objection in your mind from the point of view of the patient, provided you know the exact chances of falling into the population, not the exact chances, the chances of falling into the population. So, but I just wanted to mention that in passing and for completeness, because it is quite popular. But to me, it's one of the less attractive options for non-ascertainable outcomes, and that the use of coarsening of the data, as it's sometimes called, or ranking or categorizing with the event that's intruding on the outcome being used as a worst category is a bit more interpretable. And one thing that would be worth mentioning, you've actually covered a lot of the material in just about two sentences there, that is kind of inherent in this discussion, where you mentioned all those approaches for ranked data and for categorized data. One approach that about which Wang and Pocock published in 2016, and which in fact I first came across in a PSI presentation by Jane Temple of GSK, is this idea where you have data ranked within a visit of the win ratio. Have you come across that? It's an interesting, to me, interesting way of dealing with ranked data, because it gives you a quantitative estimate that it at least has some hope of decent interpretation.
So what's a win ratio?
Well, if you have data ranked within a visit in a clinical trial, then we've all learned about the U statistic in our non-parametric statistics course at university. It's a bit like that. If you take for each patient, you count the number of other patients who have a worse score and a better score than that patient, based on the ranks, which if you include death would include the rank of death and maybe include the rank of time of death. So you end up then with each patient contributing to an overall score. And you can then add up the scores achieved by the patients in one treatment group and versus those in the rival treatment group. And you get a ratio known as the win ratio. And it has an interpretation which is at least tolerably understandable to me, I think, that if it's greater than one, then your odds, is that the correct term, having a better score are that much better than the rival treatment. And so even though you're stuck with this ranked score, which then deprives you of the meaning of the original, say, in this case, in our example, deprives you of the meaning of the quality of life score itself, you do get this a decent sense of how much better you're likely to be with reference to in our case, with reference to the quality of life, including with reference to the fact that you might die on the study. The win ratio takes account of all of that in a way that's reasonably neat, I think. And there are methods for getting confidence intervals and so on.
In terms of that, so I have studied non-parametrics actually a lot at university. Mm-hmm. I did my master and my PhD thesis in that area. And that sounds like you're very similar to looking into the mean ranks in one group divided to the mean ranks in the other group. There's also the other possibilities that you look into these in a standardized ranks and means of that in one group minus in the other group. And that gets you, so to say, to a relative effect. And that way you can actually calculate it in such a way that it gives you the probability of being better in one group than being
exactly.
in the other group. So an alternative interpretation would be, if you choose randomly a patient from group A and randomly a patient from group B, it gives you the probability that the patient on group A is better than on group B. And, you know, that probability, of course, if it's 0.5, 50%, then both treatment groups are called kind of mm-hmm. comparable. Also, you know, say, you know, and that could be, for example, also the case if both are normally distributed just with different standard deviations, but with the same mean, you would mm-hmm. have that outcome. And the more, you know, one distribution shifts to being better, you get, you know, a shift to, you know, more 100% areas. And so that's an alternative way to come up with some kind of description of the treatment effect, which is kind of one of the, let's say, difficult things in non-parametric analysis, that, you know, by nature, it doesn't rely on parameters, which we usually use to, you know, describe treatment effects. But if you don't have them, you need to come up with alternative ways to describe treatment effects.
Right. That's put a lot better than I could have put it, Alexander. Thank you very much. And it's that talk of the probability of being better is the kind of language used also in with reference to the win ratio.
Yeah. And I think some people like ratios, other people like differences. So anyway.
But a thing you have to bear in mind when you're choosing not only your way, the mode of composite that you want to go for, but also the analysis approach, is just the requirements of the particular study and the particular indication and the particular score. These are cliches, but it's worth just saying them all again, that every approach has its assumptions, some approaches have more to offer in terms of hypothesis testing, while others concede a little towards our need for estimating some quantity. Something like, you know, you could use for these it would be possible to use quantile regression if you are interested in getting some kind of quantitative estimate of difference, but you probably even quantile regression, as I understand it, needs some kind of assumptions if you're interested in giving a difference in treatment between treatment groups. There's an assumption that the difference consists of a shift in distribution. And then you may be familiar with this. And that may or may not pertain. I think it's true to say that the win ratio, for instance, and maybe what you're describing there, the win ratio doesn't require that assumption.
So there's a lot of research about this relative effect published by a work group around Professor Brunner from Göttingen. Mm-hmm. So if you look into his publication list in the books that he published, you can find lots of stuff how to do it there. And I'm pretty sure there's also R code available to actually run these things. And it's pretty flexible. It basically just assumes that you have IID patients, so all come from the same distribution and are independently sampled, and then you're pretty flexible.
Right, but that may not pertain, of course, as I'm sure we've all seen instances where the distributions stubbornly looked different as between the treatment groups, for instance. But yeah, no, I understand.
Yeah, no. The assumption is that within a treatment group, it's the same,
right. Okay. You know,
that you're coming from. Mm. Yeah. So not between the treatment group, within the treatment group. So you could have, you know, in one treatment group, you could have a nicely normal distribution, and the other treatment group, it could be completely left, right or left skewed.
Right.
So that's possible. Yeah.
Talking about R code, by the way, we made a nice discovery that I seem to be pushing the win ratio quite a bit, but I don't mean to be too proselytizing about it. But there's a package in R which offers an adjusted version of the win ratio called Stratified Analysis Nonparametric, or SANON. And that's worth a look because, you know, adjustment for continuous covariables can make quite a difference to the sensitivity of an analysis. So I'd urge people to have a look at that. We've certainly used it and found it to be easy to use and seems to provide reasonable results. So SANON.
Yeah. So I know that there's a publication from the 80s or 90s called the Van Elteren test. That sounds very similar. It's where you basically look into a Wilcoxon test by each baseline category and then model across it. And just by chance, I wrote my master and PhD thesis about this topic. So if you look into there's actually a biometrics paper published by myself about this topic. You can have a look.
Kudos there. But this is actually goes further, though. I remember that was one of the first things I learned on starting to analyze clinical trials was the Van Elteren, because it's so important and helpful. But this is where you actually can include continuous variables as such, not as kind of pseudo stratified. It's using that idea of Gary Cook, who I have to mention because he's a co-founder of the organization that I first joined. But he's continues to be a great help to our group, and he actually worked with Kawaguchi and others to provide this R package, which uses the same method, basic method that he published on many years ago for just for non-parametrically adjusted estimates. Must be more than 20 years ago now, but applied here ingeniously to the win ratio and similar statistics.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that publication is at least in the 90s. It's kind of, it's not completely non-parametric like the research by Pona et al., but it's also not completely parametric. So I would say it goes somewhere in the middle, but it's definitely worth looking into. Yeah, completely agree. Okay, so now we talked about lots of different ways of coming up with composite endpoints. We also now touched on a couple of different meaningful ways to analyze such endpoints, taking into account ranks and having different ways to analyze it, completely parametric, non-parametric, taking into account covariates and things like this. I think there's one other thing that we should shortly touch on, and that is the problem if we have kind of multiple visits and we want to analyze across multiple visits. So one way of dealing with that is, you know, having certain kind of repeated measurements approaches. But what other kind of areas are there that we can tackle this approach or tackle this problem of multiple measurements?
No, I'm not sure I have a great answer to that. I know that that package I mentioned allows for correlations between visits. But I'm not sure that those correlations are within subject correlations, which is what you'd really like to take into account in our standard repeated measures approaches. So I'm not sure.
Do some kind of area under the curve approach across all the different visits?
Yes, indeed. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. So this is you could regard that kind of approach as another form of composite approach, because, for instance, one variant on the area under the curve approach is to count as being contributing to the bulk of that area all scores up to the time of the intrusive event, say death. And so that death, while not directly being part of the quantity, influences the size of the quantity, because obviously if death is early, then the area under the curve will be correspondingly smaller, and conversely, if the patient remains alive, their area under the curve will tend to be as big as it could be, as it were. So yes, that is one way of taking results over time into account, and thank you for reminding me of it. It's believe it or not, there are publications which talk about, well, we find it difficult to see the point, and to talk about area under the curve estimated from the time point parameters in a conventional repeated measures analysis. But that is to us an utterly confusing approach, because you've included all kinds of assumptions in your conventional repeated measures analysis, and the area under the curve is only going to add to the confusion. But where it is useful is where you use the area under the curve at the subject, calculated at the subject level, so that a subject's contribution really is contingent or dependent upon the whether this intrusive event, death or dropping out or whatever, occurred early or late. There's always the issue that people do raise with the area under the curve, that an area under the curve is very elastic in terms of what may have actually happened. So a subject could have a rather good looking area under the curve because they benefited a lot from the drug, but the drug was so potent that it killed them. And so that
okay.
So that you could have extreme benefit followed by an extinguishing event of some kind, and the AUC will not allow you to distinguish between those two. But that's just a caveat. You have to include it. Every estimand and estimator has its pluses and minuses, and for AUC that's generally quoted as being the most kind of worthy of consideration, that you bulk everything together. Sorry.
Yeah, but of course, if you just look into the outcome at the end of the study, you could argue completely the same way. You know, if you can't see whether, you know, for most of the time the patient was actually very good or whether poor, just at the last visit he goes into the other direction. And then,
exactly.
What's really, really good. So I think it always makes sense to look at these things from different angles to completely understand the data. And if there are certain kind of patterns that are very different between the treatment groups, then that's anyway of bigger interest.
I totally agree. And if you like it, it's advice I probably would confess to the wish to look at things at least three different ways before feeling you understand the first way properly. And that's where I would urge people to come to our talk at PSI on this subject, which we're discussing now, where we'll extend the discussion to the area of principal stratum approaches, which I think may not be the best for some kind of primary estimate, but which I find really helpful interpreting other estimators. But that's the subject for another day. Definitely would recommend people to think about, read up on and inform themselves about the principal stratum approach as a supportive analysis where an event like death, say, censors your score.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. In both ways, that this approach is very, very nice. And coming to the conference in London early June will surely be a nice event as well. Okay, so in summary, we talked about lots of different ways of looking into composite endpoints. We talked about the benefits and the challenges of the interpretation and the analysis of these different things. We'll put lots of links into all the different literature that we mentioned into the show notes. So you can, you know, just go to theeffectivestatistician.com, look up this episode, and find their further reading. If you want to make sure that you get all these kind of things in time, just go also to the homepage and subscribe to the newsletter, then you'll never miss an episode. Or also just subscribe on your podcast player to not miss something. Okay, with that, any kind of final words that you would like the listener to hear, Michael?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for the opportunity for talking about this subject. I would, it's a bit late, but I want to throw in just a consideration about other forms of dealing with categories. One that we found worth considering, and again, we'll talk more about this at the conference, as opposed to the cumulative odds, you can have the continuation ratio approach. And this is particularly helpful if you're dealing with death, because if you remember the cumulative odds has assumptions about the transition from one category to another, that the condition on all previous categories. And that can be a difficulty if one of the categories is death, which people often would feel, well, the odds of that happening are going to be in some way qualitatively different from other categories. So there's a thing called continuation ratio, which is really helpful with that, which uses a narrow assumption. So it's one to assure people that you're not stuck with the cumulative odds in terms of analyzing categories if you're going that route. The continuation ratio is worth exploring, and come to the conference and learn more.
Very good. Come to the conference and learn more is a very, very nice end statement. Okay, thanks so much for the discussion today, and see you all at the conference.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
This show was created in association with PSI. Next week, we will talk about the benefit-risk approach and subgroup analysis for patient preference data. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to sign up for the webinar. Just go to theeffectivestatistician.com/webinar and sign up there. So, reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.